Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the House he impeached as sitting president for only the third time since our country was founded. Despite the historic nature of the moment, the partisan vote had been predicted for weeks, but the consequences it may have for the president seem very uncertain, as does the question of when Democrats will send the articles of impeachment to the Senate. So, what are the possible outcomes, and what could it mean for the president's future? What better person to ask than Susan Page of USA Today? She's covered six White House administrations. She joins me on our last podcast of the decade to look back on quite a tumultuous year in Washington. Susan Page, here we are, the third president in U.S. history to have been impeached. What an extraordinary few months this country has been through.
It's been remarkable. You know, it's just been 85 days between the announcement by Speaker Nancy Pelosi of the formal impeachment inquiry and the House vote impeaching him. Two articles of impeachment. As you said, just the third president in American history to have this taint. It is a historic moment, and it came really quickly in a way. In a way, not so quickly, because we've had investigations of President Trump from the start, but the accelerated pace of the Ukraine investigation has been one for the history books.
And the claim now is that it was not only rushed, but it was there right from day one of his presidency. That is what Republicans are saying.
It is true that there were some Democrats who wanted to impeach President Trump from the day he was inaugurated. However, Speaker Pelosi was not one of them. She was very reluctant on impeachment. She held back her most liberal members who wanted to impeach the president at the point that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, presented his report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. It was only with when it was revealed that the president had encouraged the president of Ukraine to dig up dirt on one of his political rivals that Speaker Pelosi and more moderate Democrats got on board.
So that had it not been for that telephone conversation and the whistleblower's comments, you don't think this would have happened?
You know, on July 24th, when Robert Mueller finished testifying, I think all of us assumed that there was not going to be the impeachment of the president. Mueller had not galvanized public opinion in a way that Pelosi said was necessary to justify impeachment. And then on July 25th, on the next day, the president had this conversation with the president of Ukraine. If he had not done that, I don't think we'd be here today. I don't think that the president would have been impeached.
There's been a lot of speculation about the timing of that phone call coming the day after Mueller's report. What do you make of that instinctively?
I think that it may indicate that the president felt emboldened by the end of the Mueller investigation, felt empowered to do whatever he wanted, felt free to look ahead to the next election. Joe Biden was his and is the front runner for the Democratic presidential nomination, his most likely opponent. And that was the subject of that phone call, to encourage an investigation of Joe Biden and his son Hunter, and Hunter's actions and Joe Biden's actions when Joe Biden was vice president. So I think that the timing is probably not accidental.
There's also some confusion in the minds, I think, of many people as to what Joe Biden was doing as vice president about the investigation into Ukraine's top lawyer, because there was the feeling, supported by countries around the world, that this guy was a bad actor.
Joe Biden, while he was vice president, was the Obama administration's point person on Ukraine. He went to Ukraine and pressured the Ukrainian government to address corruption and to get rid of the top investigator who was seen as himself corrupt. In doing that, he was backed by the Obama administration and by much of the rest of the Western world, by other European leaders. There was a consensus that Ukraine had to do something about corruption to become part of the kind of community of Western nations. What Joe Biden also did, though, as vice president, was fail to prevent his son from taking a high-priced contract with a Ukrainian gas company. And it's not that either Joe Biden or Hunter Biden are accused of wrongdoing in connection with that contract, but that creates definitely a perception problem.
Appearance is everything.
I mean, when Republicans ask why did the Ukrainian gas company want to hire Hunter Biden, it is undeniable that they wanted to do so to get influence with his father. So while there's not an accusation of wrongdoing, there is definitely a perception problem and a failure to prevent the situation now that has caused the Bidens so much grief.
Is there any indication that Hunter Biden approached his father first while he was vice president and said, as I would hope my kid would have, Dad, do you see anything wrong with this? Do you see any problems with this?
So we know that both Joe Biden and Hunter Biden say that there was never that conversation. And of course, Hunter Biden's an adult. You could argue he's free to make his own decisions. However, when you're vice president of the United States, there are, I think, expectations that you will avoid wrongdoing and the perception of wrongdoing. You'll avoid corruption and the perception of corruption. And so the question is, should that have proceeded in a different way when Hunter Biden was hired? And I think that even the Bidens, if they were speaking honestly now, would say yes.
Tell me about Republicans now on this impeachment effort and the vote. Were you at all surprised at how in lockstep they were during the process?
I think two things surprised me about the Republicans. One is that they are totally united. Not a single Republican in the House voted in favor of the articles of impeachment. Not a single Republican in the House voted in favor of the impeachment inquiry. Even though some of the Republicans in the House, a few of them, had expressed concerns about the president's behavior when it came to Ukraine. But not even Will Hurd, the Republican from Texas, who has at times split with the president on substantive issues, at times criticized the president, and is retiring from Congress, is not running against, even he voted against the articles of impeachment. That was one surprise. The second surprise about Republicans was what they said during the debate, because not a single Republican said, the president is a good man who never would have done something wrong. No one said, it's totally okay to do what he did in the call with Ukraine. What they did was attack the process. They said the process was unfair. They said the president hadn't gotten due process. They said that the hearings had been rushed and the whole process had been rushed. They accused Democrats of various things wrongdoing. They raised the issue of Joe Biden, but they did not defend the president's character.
Now, one, how do you think Susan Collins, her vote as the senator from Maine, who has apparently been thought by a lot of people who might, in fact, defect.
So Susan Collins is one of those senators that we'll be watching closely as the Senate debate begins, as the Senate trial begins, because she is a more moderate Republican. She has at times, a few times, been willing to buck her party, although less often than some would think on issues like health care. And she is also one of the senators, Republican senators, up for reelection next year who come from states where voting to acquit the president might create political problems. Cory Gardner in Colorado is another one. There are a few Republican senators we'll be watching to see if they decide to break with the president because they believe it's the right thing to do and also because it may help them politically. Another senator we're watching is Mitt Romney of Utah. Mitt Romney has incredible standing, a former governor of Massachusetts, a former Republican presidential nominee. from a state, a Republican state, but a state that is less, where President Trump is less popular than in some other red states, would he be willing to break with the president? We don't know. There are stronger prospects of candidates, of office holders, on legislators on both sides, Republicans and Democrats, of crossing party lines than there were in the House.
And what about Democrats? Nancy Pelosi had some trouble keeping all those Democrats together, did she not?
You know, she initially, there was some dissent in the caucus, in the Democratic caucus, because there were some moderate members from districts that President Trump carried who didn't want to impeach the president for a long time. There were members that wanted to impeach him on a lot of different other issues as well for a long time. But at the end of the day, the Democratic caucus was remarkably unified. You had just two Democrats vote against the first article of impeachment, just three Democrats vote against the second article of impeachment. When you think that there are 31 Democrats who represent districts that Trump carried, that is a lower rate of erosion than I think most of us expected. She also made the point that they didn't whip the vote, which means they didn't deploy the resources of the leadership to tell members how to vote. Now, it was pretty clear to Democratic members of Congress the way Nancy Pelosi was hoping they would vote, but they didn't make it a matter of party loyalty. And even so, she held almost all of her troops.
Now that the vote has been taken to impeach the president, Nancy Pelosi has decided to hold the impeachment and not send it forward to the Senate yet. Tell me the thinking behind that and where this idea to hold came from.
You know, I was covering the impeachment vote for USA Today on Wednesday, and I was surprised when Nancy Pelosi, in the press conference that she had just after the vote, said she wasn't ready to move forward. Now, we had a clue of that because she hadn't submitted the names of the House managers, the House members who are going to go argue the case, present the case at the Senate trial. But the idea that she was going to deliberately hold it as a pressure point on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to in setting the rules to go forward. She says, you know, I don't know what the rules are going to be like, so I can't name the managers. And if you can't name the managers, you can't actually send the impeachment articles to the Senate. This is an idea that Lawrence Tribe had talked about in an op-ed that had gotten a lot of attention. Some liberal members of her caucus had said they should do this as a pressure point. Some of them have suggested they should hold it. Jim Clyburn suggested maybe you'd hold them and never send them forward. Maybe you'd hold them in perpetuity. But we didn't realize that Nancy Pelosi thought that was a good idea. And yesterday, Thursday, I was at her regular weekly news conference where she talked about this again. She hasn't drawn a firm line in the sand. She hasn't said, I won't send these until this and this and this happen. But she reiterated that she's going to hold on to them in the hopes of encouraging or forcing the Senate Majority Leader to set clearer rules for how the Senate trial will proceed.
Of course, having Mitch McConnell say at the outset, I'm taking my lead from the White House, from the president himself. I mean, I, as a citizen, found that shocking. Should I have been shocked?
It was surprising when Mitch McConnell said that he did not see himself as an impartial juror. He saw himself as someone who was there to make sure that President Trump is acquitted. And that is a surprise because we think about this impeachment process. You know, none of us are that familiar with the impeachment process because this will just be the third time we'll have had a Senate trial. But I think the Constitution envisions the Senate as an impartial jury who considers the case that is presented by the House. And for the Senate Majority Leader, who controls so much of what will happen in this trial, to say he is not an impartial juror, for him to meet repeatedly with officials from the White House to try to figure out what to do going forward, I think did shock a lot of people.
So what does this mean going forward? Do we have any idea whether Nancy Pelosi might actually hold on to it and not send it forward? If she did that, what would that indicate? What would that mean?
Well, the people at the White House, officials at the White House, are now suggesting that would mean that the president was never impeached, because they're arguing that the impeachment is the act of sending it to the Senate. I think that it is unlikely that Nancy Pelosi will choose to do that. I actually think it is unlikely that Speaker Pelosi is going to delay a long time. You know, that we talk about it being a delay now, but the fact is this is a meaningless delay at the moment because the House and Senate have gone home for the holidays.
Sure.
They come back on January 6th. Nothing would have happened until January 6th, even if she had gone ahead and immediately sent the articles of impeachment to the Senate. I'm inclined to think that that it will look pretty tricky if she doesn't forward the articles of impeachment. She's tried to be careful to make this look like not as a political act, but as a constitutional one. And I think that there will be the risk that she could open herself to a lot of criticism of kind of acting in a political way.
Do you see Mitch McConnell giving in to any demand whatsoever?
So here's the thing. Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell are both great poker players. I don't mean actually playing poker. I just mean that they are skilled in this exercise in which they are now engaged. And I don't know how it comes out, but they both have some cards to play, and they both have some vulnerabilities as well on this. And so I'm inclined to think that they'll reach some kind of accommodation that prompts Nancy Pelosi to send the articles of impeachment over. But if what that comprises, I have no idea.
And a quick break. When we come back, more from Susan Page.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Susan Page. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today and author of The Matriarch, Barbara Bush, and the Making of an American Dynasty. So just to help us understand what actually happens once it gets to the Senate, you have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court sitting in judgment. Is that the case? Does he say anything?
So the Constitution does provide that the Chief Justice presides over the trial.
Right.
But it does not give the Chief Justice the power to set the rules. 51 senators get to set the rules.
Then why is he there at all?
Well, the Constitution calls for him to be there. I think it reflects the gravitas of impeachment. It includes the third branch of government in an impeachment process. He also, even if he doesn't have the power to set rules, he will have the authority to speak. So if there's something going on that he thinks is wrong, he could speak out about it. I mean, he's got soft power in that way. But even though he's presiding, in a way, he is not actually in charge.
And what about the issue of witnesses? Even if Mitch McConnell says, we're not calling any witnesses in behalf of President Trump, can the Democrats call witnesses?
The Democrats can call witnesses if they can get 51 votes for calling the witnesses. Now, that's not impossible. You'd need a couple Republicans to come over to
your side.
Just
a couple?
Just a couple. On the other hand, party discipline has been pretty fierce on this issue. But it is possible. It is possible for them to call witnesses. It's possible that that won't be allowed. You know, this has been an issue that divided the White House and the Senate Majority Leader. President Trump has said, at least said publicly, that he would like a lot of witnesses. He suggested that maybe they should call Hunter Biden and Joe Biden as witnesses as well. Mitch McConnell has really squelched that idea because he thinks that carries a lot of risks, and it might look kind of circus-like. And he has, I think, convinced the White House, at least for now, that they want to have no witnesses. But this is one more of those things that I think you've got to let the process unfold before we know for sure whether there are going to be any witnesses or not.
So do you think there is going to be negotiation over this Christmas holiday break?
Yes. I think there'll be behind the scenes an
right.
effort to reach a deal to break the impasse so that the articles of impeachment go forward. I think that that is probably, Democrats and the White House both think that's a good idea. Mitch McConnell says it's fine with him if they never send him over. I'm not sure that's actually what he thinks.
It's so interesting how this could play out if Mitch McConnell says there will be no witnesses. This could be over in one day.
Probably not. Probably not in a day, because you have the House gets to present its case, but it could be over in a week or in 2 weeks. It could be over by February 1st. That has been the thinking until this issue of sending over the articles of impeachment. Our assumption was that the Senate trial would begin the second or third week of January and take a week or two. Maybe that slides if they have some trouble working this out. But I think there is every expectation this will be over early in the year.
Are there any surprises that could upend this whole process?
Yes. The surprises would be, I think the biggest chance of a surprise would be the disclosure of information that we don't have yet. Say, for instance, John Bolton, the president's former national security advisor.
Who spoke on Morning Edition today.
But refused to talk about impeachment.
Right.
Say he decided to speak out about things he saw or the perspective he had on what the president did. That would be something that could be very dramatic. And, of course, senators often display less party discipline than House members. And getting to 51 votes in the Senate doesn't take that many Republicans to flip to get to that. So if you had some really dramatic disclosure that raised questions about the president's fitness for office, it is conceivable that that would have a big effect.
And of course, I would imagine that that's what Democrats are hoping for in that kind of a public trial.
That's one reason Chuck Schumer, the Democratic Senate leader, called for John Bolton to come and testify before them. It's also one reason Republicans would like to have this over quickly.
Of course.
And the president would like to have this over quickly as well, so that he can claim, his intention, I think, is to argue that even though he was impeached by the House, he was acquitted by the Senate, and therefore his record has been cleared.
Susan, I have heard some commentators express the view that by this summer, nobody is going to be talking about impeachment during the presidential campaign, that it's all going to be over, done with, and out of their minds. What's your view?
One of the big surprises has been how set public opinion is about impeachment and about the president. You know, we've had these dramatic hearings in the House before the Intelligence Committee and then before the Judiciary Committee, and it didn't move the needle in any significant way in people's attitudes about impeachment or about President Trump. And we did a poll last week, a USA Today Suffolk poll, in which we said, here are 12 big issues. What's going to be most important in affecting your vote for president in 2020? Impeachment was one of those issues. It came in at number 11. The only thing cited less often by Americans as an issue that would affect their vote was transportation.
Well, I want to remind you, which I don't think I really need to do, how wrong the polls were in the last election.
I think we should be humble about predicting what is going to happen in a presidential election and what forces are going to affect people's views before that election. I completely agree with you on that.
Tell me about the Democrats and where they currently stand in this presidential race. There was a debate. There were just 7 Democrats on the stage. Joe Biden did the best that he has done. He was calm. He was straightforward. He didn't stumble. Does he remain the front runner?
Joe Biden is the front runner. And he's been a pretty durable front runner. You know, he's not in some ways run that great a campaign. There have been debates where he looked kind of flummoxed. But his support has stuck with him. And he did look good. He spoke well in the debate in Los Angeles. And, you know, the fire was mostly directed at Pete Buttigieg at that debate because he is now seen as a rising alternative to Joe Biden. So he got some criticism from Amy Klobuchar and also from Elizabeth Warren. I think you'd have to say Biden is not only the front runner, he is a more significant front runner. He's a more durable front runner than we thought he would be. And that doesn't mean he's going to win the nomination, but it means if you're placing bets now, your first bet would be on him.
Mayor Bloomberg, what do you think his chances are?
I think it's tough for a septuagenarian from New York to burst through and win the Democratic nomination. I think he's not a great fit with where the energy is in the Democratic Party. The one thing, there are two things that give him the possibility. So one is he's got a ton of dough and he's willing to spend it.
You bet.
The other is that Democrats care most of all, not about ideology, but about defeating President Trump next year. So if Bloomberg, if the former New York mayor is seen as the candidate who is kind of uniquely able to defeat President Trump, then he's got a great chance at the nomination. But that is also the argument that Joe Biden is making. And Joe Biden is in many ways a better fit, I think, with where the party is now.
With where the party is, which of the two do you think might be able to stand up in a debate with Donald Trump and come out on top?
You know, they'd be different. Bloomberg is a more combative figure, I think. Joe Biden is somebody who can get who projects kind of a softer, as a rule, projects a softer image. He's more senatorial. You know how senators are reasonably cordial in Senate debates, maybe less so today than they were a decade ago.
Sure.
But they have a different style. But they're making, of course, a similar point, which is that their argument is that President Trump has violated democratic norms, led our country in the wrong direction, and that we need to get back to some old ways and old courtesies of doing things. And President Trump, of course, will make the argument that he's been a disruptive influence in ways that needed disruption.
However, it's not so much what either would say, but how President Trump would conduct himself on that stage. I'll never forget watching him sort of stalk Hillary Clinton.
You know that Democrats are looking at President Trump's debate history with Hillary Clinton and also with the Republicans in 2016 to try to figure out what is the best approach to use with him. Is the best approach to, like, try to stay above it, which I think is what Hillary Clinton tried to do? Are you better off punching back hard? I gather you would punch back hard, Diane.
I would punch back hard. Indeed, because I also think he has problems with women. As an example, his comments about Debbie Dingell and her husband, which I found absolutely outrageous. Talk about what he said.
He was speaking at a rally in Battle Creek, Michigan. The state,
John Dingell's home state.
That's right. And he said that he hadn't gotten appropriate credit for actions he took when John Dingell died. John Dingell, the longest serving member of Congress in the history of our country. And he made derogatory comment about Debbie Dingell's looks. And then he said that in a conversation he had with Debbie Dingell, where Debbie Dingell thanked him for allowing flags to half staff when John Dingell died, said that John, her husband, would have been so pleased looking down, meaning looking down from heaven. And he said at this rally that maybe John Dingell would be looking up, meaning looking up from hell.
And Debbie Dingell responded?
She said that it was very hurtful. She said she's approaching the first Christmas without her husband, the love of her life. And she said something should be off limits. And on that, I think she has gotten broad support, including from at least one Republican House member from Michigan. And I heard the number four ranking Democrat in the House, Binray Luhan, doing an interview with MSNBC, where he said that he thought the reaction of Michiganders would be such that Donald Trump had made it more likely he would lose Michigan next year by his comments.
Which he won.
Which he won, and which is one of those handful of Midwestern states that determined the outcome of the 2016 election.
Looking back, Susan, you and I have been friends and colleagues for so many years. Could you have imagined that 2019 would have ended up this way?
You know, I think about when I went to journalism school, the things I never thought I would cover, the 9/11 attacks, a tied presidential election in 2000, an impeachment of Bill Clinton, and now covering a second presidential impeachment at a time our country just seems to be ripped apart. It is not something I ever thought I would cover. We've seen, you know, we've seen times when our country has had strife and tension and demonstrations and assassinations. I just feel like this has gotten to be the worst. It is, I think, perilous. And I worry about the future of our country.
What is it that worries you most?
I worry that we've lost an ability to both talk to each other and to listen to one another. You know, when I go out to cover events, I'm struck by how Americans love their country, how devoted Americans are to the Constitution, but they have very different visions about what it means to say you love America. And it's like it's something we need to be able to talk about to have our democracy survive.
And on that note, I want to wish you happy holidays. You need a holiday after all of this. And I wish all the best for you and our country in the new year.
And Diane, I would say in response that the ability to talk to and listen to people with other points of view has been a hallmark of your entire career. So happy holidays.
Thank you. And that's all for today. We'll have a couple of special holiday rebroadcasts for you over the next couple of weeks. So look for those in your podcast feed. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Our engineer this week is Josephine Neonai. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and Happy New Year to all. I'm Diane Rehm.